The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss everything about the hit BBC series, Doctor Who. And today we're discussing the fourth Doctor story, The Androids of Tara. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
And Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Folks, be sure to write a review of the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from that allow you to rate or review shows. That really helps us a lot. Also, another thing that really helps a lot is sharing the podcast with your friends. Help us grow this community and reach more listeners. And, of course, once we're done, you know, or as we're talking about classic Doctor Who, a new season of the 15th Doctor of Doctor Who is coming up, and your Doctor Who loving friends will want to get started listening to the podcast as we get to that especially. I want to tell you about, before I tell you that, I want to encourage you to stick around to the end of the show. We have more of your great listener feedback, and I want to tell you about another show on the StarQuest Network that you're sure to enjoy called The Secrets of Stargate, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are found, or at sqpn.com/Stargate. But we're talking about the androids of Tara, so Jimmy, could you give us a recap of what happens in this story?
This week, the Fourth Doctor and the First Romana are hunting the fourth segment of the Key to Time. The Doctor goes fishing, but Romana finds the segment in less than 7 minutes. Unfortunately, they've stumbled into a beat-for-beat performance of The Prisoner of Zenda, only with androids. Prince Reynard is to be crowned King of Tara, but he's kidnapped by the evil Count Grendel, so the Doctor has a faulty android that looks like him crowned in his place. This temporarily thwarts the plans of Count Grendel, who wants to be king himself, and Grendel has several alternate plans to become king. Ultimately, he wants to marry the second in line to the throne, Princess Strella, to King Reynard. Then the king will have an unfortunate accident, Grendel will marry Queen Stella, and then she'll have an unfortunate accident too, leaving Grendel the new king. Only Princess Strella won't cooperate. However, it turns out that Romana looks exactly like Princess Strella, so being the enemy of the world that he is, Count Grendel forces Romana to marry the king in her place. Only the Doctor interrupts the wedding, beats Count Grendel in a fencing match, lets the king's men into the castle, and soon they're in control of the situation. Ultimately, just like in The Prisoner of Zenda, Count Grendel jumps into the moat and swims off to escape. The Doctor and Romana then take the fourth segment of The Key to Time and head on their way. The end.
So, overall impressions, Father Corey.
This is one that confused me as a kid, of course, because of the whole androids and the real one and Romana and the queen, the princess and all that. But as I watch it now, it's one of those that's okay. It's fine. It's an episode. It's not very memorable, but it's okay.
Okay. All right. Jimmy, how about you?
Well, I'll agree it wasn't very memorable from when I was a kid because I had completely forgotten this. But in watching it, it has a decent plot that moves fairly quickly, and it's nice for once to have a Key to Time adventure where we don't get the Key to Time segment at the very end. Instead, we get it at the very beginning, and then there's a complicating plot that is really what this is about. And that's a nice change of pace. It's the only one in the Key to Time series that's like that. And, you know, they've basically completely lifted the plot from The Prisoner of Zenda. I mean, this is really beat for beat The Prisoner of Zenda, only with androids. And that makes it a decent plot. The Prisoner of Zenda spawned an entire subgenre of literature, which is known as Ruritanian romance. Romance in the sense of a novel, not a romantic story. And Prisoner of Zenda was set in an imaginary European country called Ruritania, and it became so popular that other people started writing novels in imaginary European countries. It freed you up from having to conform your novel to known European political relations, so it gave writers more liberty. And so Prisoner of Zenda is a good plot, and this has a good plot. It just didn't, it wasn't memorable for me as a child.
You know, I would say The Princess Bride is part of that genre because of all the country. And there are a lot of little beats in this one that you find in The Princess Bride, like a lot of the similar characters and motivations and that sort of thing, which I find very interesting. As far as my impression goes, I kind of agree. It has its moments, mostly Tom Baker moments, you know, where he's especially humorous and funny or, you know, quirky or whatever. Those are mostly the bits that I like. And frankly, that's in a lot of Tom Baker's stories. It's his zaniness that really comes across. So I did like that. I did find it interesting. They have Mary Tam, the actress who plays Romana. She's actually does four separate roles technically in this one. Mm-hmm. She's Romana, Romana's android, Princess Stella, and Strella. Princess Stella's android, Strella. Mm-hmm. Sorry, yeah. It's like, I can see as a kid, this would be very confusing. Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah, so it's kind of odd. If Jimmy, you mentioned like they wanted this was beat for beat Prisoner of Zenda. They apparently wanted to call this the Androids of Zend.
Yeah,
and the lawyers at the BBC said, no, that's a step too far.
You mentioned liking Tom Baker moments in this, and of course his moments are always good, but I like Romana in this. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, Mary Tam only did the one season. She did the Key to Time season, and then Lala Ward took over the Romana role. And the only reason they've ever cited, there were a bunch of rumors about why she only did one season, but she's basically said why. She was not interested in being a companion who gets caught and has to be rescued all the time. And then she thought, and she was promised that would not be the case, that as a Time Lady, she would be an equal to the Doctor. And then she thought her character took on the damsel in distress characteristic, and she didn't like that, so she wanted to leave. But in this, even though she gets caught, she's still not a damsel in distress.
No.
She's an active agent. She's working the situation. And she has some really great moments, too. One of my favorites is when Count Grendel unveils the Romana android, which he has programmed to kill the Doctor. Apparently in multiple ways. We only see one of them, but if it hears Tom Baker's voice, a blue beam of something lashes out from its belt and destroys what's ever in front of it. And so it's not like it even has to physically grapple with him, just zap and Tom Baker will be dead, is the plan. And Grendel's very proud of this, and because it looks just like her, and of course she's gorgeous, and she's also wearing a costume that Mary Tam herself designed. It's very striking. It uses her two favorite colors, purple and teal. And it's a very striking costume, but Grendel is very proud of his android duplicate, and he says, "You see before you the complete killing machine, as beautiful as you and as deadly as the plague. If only she were real, I'd marry her." And Romana says, "You deserve each other."
Yeah. That was good.
I have to admit, Don, when you mentioned Princess Bride, and of course, all I could think of during the fencing scene where the Doctor's pretending that he doesn't know how to fence and he gets better is,
yes,
I'm not left-handed.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things that really reminded me of it was like where he kind of is pretending to not be as good as Count Grendel, and then suddenly he, you know, oh, I'm going to turn on the fencing gene, and now I'm fencing is, you know, better than you. That seemed very similar. And of course, this precedes.
Well, yeah. Maybe not the book, but the movie, because the movie came out in early 80s.
Is late 70s. This is 79.
Yep.
And that fencing scene is interesting, by the way, because the way it's shot, I mean, it's fairly slow moving, especially at the beginning, and then it picks up speed. But there is no music. It is silent. You know, all you hear is clashing swords. And that's very unusual for a climactic fencing scene to have it played so straight. I was also impressed. I have in my notes, you know, climactic fencing battle, weak, silent, no music, gets a bit stronger, predictable name drop. And that last note is, I'm expecting the doctor after the fight to say, oh, yes, I learned to fence from this famous fencing person in history. And for once, he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's so true. It's like, thank you for, I mean, we already had two name drops earlier in the series, in the story, like where he said, oh, I haven't used this fishing rod since I was last with this famous fisherman and so forth. And they, for once, they didn't name drop on us with Tom Baker.
And by the way, the famous fisherman he mentioned was Isaac Walton, English author Walton. The only reason why I caught that is because there's a historic railroad inn or hotel near Glacier Park. That's the Isaac Walton Inn.
Ah.
Which is a hotel I really want to stay at because it's a beautiful, beautiful spot.
But there's also, this serial coming out in 1979. It's after Star Wars, and therefore the fencing foils they have are electric, and so they're poor man's lightsabers.
And their crossbow bolts are electric charges, basically.
They're like Chewie's bowcaster.
Yeah, they are.
Exactly what they are.
And they refer to them, they have one of the Taran nobles say, oh, yes, that's a peasant weapon. And I'm going, it's a ranged weapon, dude. All you've got are swords.
Yeah.
But when you see what the target accuracy is, it's like, okay, this is stormtrooper level target accuracy. It's, I guess, okay, it is a peasant's weapon.
It's what equalized the peasants against the men on horseback, that's for sure. In the real world, you know, speaking of the aristocracy, the names were interesting. So Prince Reynard, it reminds us of Reynard, which is the French word for fox. Count Grendel is clearly named after the villain Grendel in Beowulf. So, you know, we have some, you know, if you've read anything, you know, really in literature, English literature, you would probably recognize clearly as soon as he's introduced, Count Grendel is the bad guy, you know, that sort of thing.
With the exception of Count Grendel, the names also were reminiscent of those used in Prisoner of Zenda.
Right. Right. Which, I never read it, but yeah, it's familiar to me. The nobility also seems clueless. It's an interesting aspect of this. They're clueless about the way things work. Only peasants can fix things. Only peasants understand even things like surgery and engineering, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of stuff. And it's kind of an interesting way of like saying, oh, you know, this is the nobility of this planet, you know, or country. They're so elevated, they're so divorced from the way the real world works. It's sort of a, you know, what am I trying to say? Like it's a dig at the aristocracy, at the idea mm-hmm. of, in some ways.
Well, you know, today the aristocracy doesn't know how their iPhones work, but then neither do the peasants either.
Watch a Senate hearing on the internet. That's usually similar. Yeah. Go ahead, Father Corey.
I do think that was an interesting way to take the idea that, the peasants were the ones who did all the trades. Mm-hmm. The bootmaker and the seamstress and all those kinds of trades, those were all done by peasants. Those were not done by the aristocracy. They were the ones who were doing the stitching, you know, on the big loom and everything. And, you know, so that's interesting to take now, you know, future technology like androids and stuff like that. And, we're actually, you know, it's still the peasants doing the trades, even though that trade is, you know, technical, you know, advanced AI design and things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the peasant woman, who's the roboticist she's got robotic skills, which none of the nobles have. I like one of the nobles. It's Swordmaster Zadek. Whose name to me, I can't unlink it to Hebrew. Zadik means righteous.
I was thinking that too. Yeah.
But he's at one point, the king is kind of expressing a wish that we knew how all this stuff worked. And he's like, if we were meant to be peasants, we would have been born peasants.
Very aristocrat way of thinking. Yeah.
But we do have this kind of, just for people who haven't seen it yet, this Atara has this kind of steampunk techno-medieval fusion mm-hmm. thing going on in its culture. Mm-hmm. So they've got, on the one hand, they've got lifelike androids, but they're also weaving cloth by hand on a loom.
And riding horses.
And
that sort of thing.
Oh, that reminds me. Because the king, the Count Grendel, has a horse that he rides, and he shows it to Romana, and she's asking about it. She doesn't know what a horse is. She's never seen one. He says, "It's my favorite charger," and she says, "How does it work?"
Yeah.
and she, it occurred to me, she's got the Jaime thing going, you know, where Jaime as a companion, whatever time he's in, he just rolls with it. It's got, mm-hmm. and he's a boy from the past. So he's encountering all this futuristic technology and he just rolls with it and accepts it and doesn't worry about it. And right. even though he doesn't understand it. And Romana has the same thing in reverse because she's from this super technologically advanced culture and she's in much less technologically advanced environments as a companion like this one. She encounters a horse. She has no clue how it goes. And so she asks, how does it work? Yeah. But she just, otherwise, she's just unflappable and curious and doesn't question and does the things she encounters. She doesn't get gobsmacked at them. She just unflappably rolls with it the way Jaime mm-hmm. does.
Yeah. One point she's escaping and has to like jump on the horse and get it to yeah. go. And she's like, go yeah. move.
You're like, and accidentally kick go. Or, you know, kicks it, you know, not realizing that's what it takes. I did kind of chuckle though, when, you know, you introduced it as a charger. Cause that's a word we don't think of for a horse today, but of course it comes from it's a charging war horse.
Yeah.
Is what right. it is. And my thought of course was I prefer my charger. The car.
Yes. With many horses under the hood.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, speaking of the electro swords they have, you know, it's mm-hmm. you can tell watching TV shows from different time periods how there were different safety standards when they were filmed. And there's one scene where Tom Baker is fishing and he's laying on his back. He's kind of given up on fishing for the moment, it seems. He's laying on his back. He's got his hat over his face. And in this close-up of the hat over his face, we see someone put one of the electro swords right up to the brim of the hat. And all of a sudden, an explosive charge goes off and it fries the brim of the hat.
Yeah.
And it's like they just detonated that right in Tom Baker's face. You would never, that would never be allowed today.
No, they'd have a.
It's sitting there smoldering after. I mean, it's not like it was quick and done.
Let's talk about the guy holding that sword at the time, Farah. He's an aide to Swordmaster Zedek, and he's on with Prince Renard's retinue. He's, you know, his guard, and
he's the stock, adamant, inflexible character for the show. Everyone else is reasonable.
He wants to run someone through with his sword. Like he's just everybody he encounters. He wants to shove his sword at him. Yeah, this guy is bloodthirsty.
He's not even content with stunning him. He's like, I want them dead.
And he's not too bright, and he's like because at one point, like, why would he think the doctor? It's, you know, there's a few like back and forth. Grendel comes, kidnaps Prince Reynard, knocks the others out, and they awake. And Farah goes, "The doctor's a traitor." Like, why? Yeah. Why do you assume he's the traitor?
Especially since 5 minutes before he just fixed the android to look like the. Prince.
Yeah.
And he got knocked out and got left behind. If he was working for Grendel, Grendel would have taken him with him.
Yeah. This is a common stock character in early Doctor Who in order to generate drama, someone has to be unreasonably adamant. And this time it's Farah. But fortunately, he's not in charge. And that's often the reverse. It's often the people who are in charge that are ridiculously adamant and inflexible. And here it's less annoying because he's a minor character. He doesn't have any power.
And he does eventually come around, but it's like halfway through the third episode before, you know, when the king's installed, the android king is installed, he does finally come around to see that, yes, the doctor is helping them.
Especially once he sees how good of a swordsman the doctor is, he's probably grateful he didn't try to. also, by the way, there's a significant event in this, which is that the doctor's scarf gets burned. He gets a whole section of it burned off by Farah's sword. I think that's the doctor's scarf is sacrosanct. In fact, he gets pretty angry at Farah and threatens him with bodily harm for messing with his scarf. I thought that was funny.
By the way, Father, you mentioned the fixing of the android so that it can be crowned king. And after it gets crowned king, the android, now it's still the same actor who plays the prince, yep, but the android has a great moment because they've gotten him crowned. So the android is now king. Everyone thinks it's biological, but it's the android, and it's sitting in this throne. And the throne, by the way, is Tim Brooke Taylor's chair from The Goodies. I don't know if y'all have ever seen The Goodies, but it's a British comedy show. I loved it as a kid. It's a lot of fun. It's about these three guys, Bill, Graham, and Tim, who will do anything, anywhere, anytime. You can hire them to do anything. And they're the goodies. They're the good guys. And they have all kinds of wacky adventures. But each one of them is a different stereotype. So Bill Oddie is a stereotype of the working man. And Graham Garden, who later for Big Finish played the meddling monk, Graham Garden is a boffin. He's an educated scientific type guy. And Tim Brooke Taylor is the upper class. So he like wears a Union Jack vest and a suit, and he's very upper class and very posh. And he has a chair that's basically a throne. And so for this story, they borrowed Tim Brooke Taylor's chair to be the throne of Tara. Nice. But there's this scene where the android is sitting on the throne, and Swordmaster Zendek and the doctor are talking about him. The doctor's been showing off how good the android can fake being the king by like talking about monastic policy and so forth, and you know how monastic lands are at the wish of the king, and I can revoke them at any time I please, but I plan to be lenient. And Zendek is a little concerned, and he takes the doctor aside. And so they're standing in the foreground with the king in the background.
I love this. Yeah.
And yeah. Zendek says, I'm a little concerned. You know, the doctor's like, he's a little smarter than the king. Yeah. Well, I did program him. And, but to start that off, Zendek says, Doctor, the prince, and then the android says, King. I love that assertiveness on the android's part. It's like, hey, I'm king now.
Both him and the other swordsman have a moment where they forget that it's actually the android, and they start treating it like it is the king, because it will say something. Oh, yes, yes, your highness. Wait a minute.
There's also that nice moment early on when Grendel has Romana back in the peasant surgeon's lab. They think she's an android, and there's this whole mistaken identity thing going on because they think she's an android copy of Princess Strella because she looks exactly like her, because why not? And so they're about to dismantle her. they've got her restrained, and what is it that they eventually makes them stop? I forget.
Romana had injured her ankle, which is part of how Count Grendel got her to his castle in the first place. He was promising to let his surgeon tend to her ankle. So he brings her in, and they've strapped her to a table with big metal things. And they've like taken a grease pencil and drawn a line across her throat for where they're going to cut her head off. Yep, right. And she's like, excuse me. but finally she directs their attention to her twisted ankle. And so, the roboticist, whose name is Madame Lamia, takes off one of Romana's shoes and feels her ankle and says, it's swelling. And that's what triggers, she's biological. An android would not have an ankle programmed to swell like this.
Yeah. Well, I love the high-tech surgery device they were going to use.
A saw.
An electric, it's an electric carving knife.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you'd use for turkey. That's right.
Dark meat or white.
Yeah.
We haven't really mentioned K-9 at all, but I like the opening where K-9 and the doctor are playing chess and K-9 is beating the doctor, which is just fun. I just love
K-9. Ramon immediately looks, meat and 12. 11, mistress. Well, sorry, K-9, you're right.
And he's mystified. Also, I want to note that Romana's wardrobe in the TARDIS is apparently organized by alphabetical order of place. Like, so she's looking for an outfit to wear on Tara, and so she's going through it, and she's naming places alphabetically as she goes through the costume. So
she has a grass skirt to wear in Tahiti.
Yep. Right. Tahiti, Tara, yes. It's surprising to go there.
But of course, it's once again the, you know, oh yes, this is what is, you know, in fashion in Tara today. It's like, nobody wears an outfit that looks like that.
And, yeah, nobody on Tara actually is dressed in that outfit, which is funny, yeah.
Well, she did say, according to the TARDIS databanks, this is what everyone is wearing on Tara this year. So the databanks may not have. It's due to the Time War, actually.
That's a classic thing in Doctor. Oh yes, this is the proper fashion. You'll see that every once in a while, and they walk out and they're so completely out of touch from everybody else.
Right.
They did have some thought to fashion. I mean, you know, both with the men and the women, like the swordsmen have certain helmets they wear and so forth. But what struck me was one of the women's fashions. You know, women in various cultures like to wear their hair kind of curled, and you see it in, you know, ancient Roman frescoes and so forth. They'll have curls that kind of stretch over their face. And here they've got those. A lot of the women have these, they look like little snakes, you know, or extended S's that have a few extra loops, and they're plastered to their skin. And at first I thought, oh, they've done this with mascara to indicate hair ringlets. But upon looking at close-ups, particularly of Madame Lamia, that's not mascara. Those are real hair loops. They've made hair loops presumably as extensions and then glued them to Madame Lamia's face.
Yep.
So this is a conscious attempt at, okay, this is a women's hairstyle. And it's not just her. Some of the women in the background have it too.
Right. You mentioned, Jimmy, that this is an episode where of the Key to Time series where the part of the Key to Time is discovered early, which made me think, like, as she's finding it, I'm thinking, well, that classic Simpsons episode, well, that wrapped up quite quickly this time. wrapped up much more quickly than usual.
Interesting. We got to see Madame Lamia then trying to figure out what the piece of the key was. You know, she's sitting there with a little Dremel trying to drill it out and, dental pick, trying to scratch it, and, of course, can't do any damage to it with anything.
Yeah, she tells Romana she's broken two diamond drill bits on it.
Which is good.
If you've got a universe-governing device, you don't want to be able to let someone easily damage it.
It should be pretty hard to break. You mentioned Grendel's plan, which is to marry Princess Strella and then kill her, which is essentially the plan of Prince Humperdinck and the Princess Bride, you know, which is to marry Princess Buttercup and then kill her on their wedding night. His primary plan, you know, on the day of the coronation is Prince doesn't show up. Then they have to find someone else because they can't go find the prince. But okay, they have to turn to someone else. And I will refuse once, but not twice, because that may seem, you know, may present the wrong. But I don't want to be too eager either. And it's just like it's so funny, like how like overly complicated his plan is. It's like, oh, like I will refuse once, but not twice, and then I will accept the crown.
Well, the customs regarding when you accept and when you refuse can be really interesting. A friend of mine is from Lebanon, but he spent a lot of time growing up in France, and his father was also Lebanese, but spent a lot of time growing up in France. And so when his father was a little boy in France, his mom was taking him to this one region, and she knew that where they were visiting, a woman was going to offer the little boy father candy. And she told him, here, the custom is you must refuse three times and then you can say yes. And so, being a little boy, his father, when the woman offered him candy, he said, no, yes.
That works.
No. Yeah. That's good. Refuse three times to say yes. I also find it in the coronation scene, the it was ironic that you had an android of Princess Strella being sent as if she was Princess Strella to swear fealty to an android that everyone thinks is the new king. So it's just like it's wheels within wheels, plots within plots.
Yeah, and of course that leads to that cliffhanger where it looks like the doctor is smashing in Romana's head.
Right. It's the robot, the android Princess Strella comes up to swear loyalty to the king, and the doctor yells no and grabs a fire poker and smashes her over the head. And then on the other side, he explains, I heard it. It's an android. I heard it click or something. And it was here to kill the king.
Mm-hmm. Madame Lamia, also manages to reconstruct the doctor's voice using a deepfake AI, mm-hmm. apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit of a foreshadowing of real technology. I guess that's the, we talked about the sword at the end and Grendel. There's this whole subplot of Grendel and Madame Lamia, and she wants him to marry her after he's done away with Strella, and he just keeps trying to get he tries to get when Strella's no longer an option, he tries to get Romana to marry him. And he just can't get anyone to marry him. This guy's.
Well, he could get Madame Lamia to marry him, but he never asks her.
She's a peasant. Of course he's not going to marry her, right? Which is the way Romana kind of gets through to her, which is if you think he's going to marry you, you're fooling yourself because he sees you as a peasant.
And she ends up dying because at one point the plot is to kill the doctor using the Romana android. And so they arrange for the doctor to meet who he thinks is going to be Romana at this Pavilion of the Summer Winds, which is like a little fancy hut. And the doctor shows up early, so he's not going to be duped. And Madame Lamia goes in first and starts talking to the doctor. And he says, okay, so where's Romana? And he doesn't believe Romana's really going to be here. He knows this is a trap. And she says, Madame Lamia says, she's outside and I'll go get her. And so she goes out to get Romana and brings her in. And it's like, doctor, aren't you going to greet your friend? which he then doesn't. Canine alerts him to the danger and he ducks. So he avoids getting hit by the blue blazer beam. But then that leads to that weapons fire, because canine fires at the android. Mm-hmm. All the weapon fire going on in the hut leads Count Grendel to order his men to open fire on the hut. And Madame Lamia comes out and gets killed. Mm-hmm. And Count Grendel is like aghast at this, and I'm going, dude, you just ordered your men to attack the hut with your friend inside it. You have no one to blame but yourself for this.
Especially didn't give orders to say, don't kill her.
Yeah. right. He's incompetent.
But he also didn't surround the hut, because then the canine is able to cut through the back and escape.
Yeah.
Genius he is not.
Yeah. I will say, though, he's a decently charming villain. He's not Roger Delgado level charming, but he can be charming and, seemingly considerate and thoughtful, even though he's going to do his evil thing. He's not as slimy as Tobias Vaughn was, but he is more genuinely charming. But not as charming as Roger Delgado's master.
Right. There is that moment right after Madame Lamia is killed where Grendel yells, doctor, I know you're in there. There's only one entrance. come out, surrender, and you have my word as a grox that I will not harm you. And so K-9's like, master, he's going to betray you. And he says, yeah. I know what I'm doing, K-9. Opens the door. They shoot at him, and he like ducks back and then ducks out again, goes, liar, and ducks in again.
Yeah.
It's funny.
That's one of a couple of moments of where – so Tom Baker in this, the Fourth Doctor, is rather rude to K-9 on multiple occasions. Like at one point later when they're trying, when they've taken a boat into this underground river to try to get into the castle from below. And K-9 is cutting their way in, just like he cut his way out of the hut. Mm-hmm. And the doctor is berating K-9 and says that a hamster with a blunt penknife would be quicker. and he says it really mean. And yep. K-9 is like, you did ask me to make no noise, master. But I know Tom Baker didn't really like working with the K-9 prop. And I'm wondering if some of that's bleeding through here. Probably. But then, as soon as Tom Baker gets inside, he has this extended speech to K-9 about stay with the boat and be very careful. And then, as soon as he ducks back into the darkness, we hear him trip and scream.
Yeah.
And so, just like at the hut when he's like, K-9, I know what I'm doing. And he goes out and gets shot, even though K-9 has told him, inadvisable, master. Here, he's all over K-9 about, now you be careful. And then, wah! And he trips.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah, that was pretty, you know. And of course, this shows that, you know, K-9's abilities are at the speed of plot, because no malfunctions. None.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
He works perfectly. No battery wear down, nothing. Though I did laugh as the final scene where K-9 is out on the boat spinning around. Help, master, help.
right.
By the way, speaking of, because I noticed too that K-9 didn't have any, his batteries wear down in this. But speaking of batteries wearing down, this is a persistent problem with the King android.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, as they're marching through the forest on their way to the coronation, one of the prince's men notices that the android isn't responding when they talk to it. And the doctor says, oh, I turned off its speech circuits to save power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, to anybody who works with computers today, turning down the volume is not the principal source of power consumption on your device.
Right.
You know, marching through the forest is going to use way more power than
you could use
than
one of those chargers
the speech
that you could
chip.
Ride.
Yeah.
Yep. Any other notes on this one, Father Corey?
Nothing here.
How about you, Jimmy? Anything left?
Yeah. So I like at the beginning where Romana is on her way to find the key to time segment, and we get a lot of these shots through the trees of watching her walk. And what these do, now some of them don't tell us this, but others communicate that there's something watching her. And this is a film technique you see in a lot of like 1970s Hammer horror movies, mm-hmm. where you see someone walking and we get these through the trees shots of them, which sometimes are innocent, but sometimes mean the person's being watched. And so I like that, you know, there's a lot of this that feels kind of like Hammer horror, because it has this kind of rustic environment, but it also has some technological additions, and you can see that kind of thing in a lot of Hammer movies. Hammer is a British film house famous for its horror movies. They did a lot of Dracula and things like that with Christopher Lee and so forth. But this walking through the forest, being seen in this way, very reminiscent of Hammer horror. Unfortunately, when we finally get to see what's menacing Romana from the bushes, wow, is it goofy. It's referred to sometimes in fandom as the Tara beast or wood beast. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to be they wanted to build a bear costume for it, but they couldn't afford to. So they had to hire a bear costume, but they still put their own face on the bear, which has these big tusks and, you know, sharp teeth. And it looks like a goofy ape monster. And yeah. It's just very goofy looking. The face is completely unrealistic. Let's see. They have some nice cultural development for Tara. I mean, they actually have a backstory for this planet. I mentioned, you know, we've talked about the nobility peasantry division. We've talked about the women's hairstyle. They also have a 16-hour clock that they have in the palace where the coronation takes place. And they make a big point. I mean, they spent the money to make this clock. They're going to make sure the audience sees it. Mm-hmm. So we see the clock counting down the time units until coronation time. But I like that they had a clock and it was something other than our 12 hours. They also talk about the origin of androids. They say that there was a plague 200 years ago that killed 9/10 of the population. And that's when they started using androids to replace human labor. So that's a nice bit of background. I have a note that it's nice to have, because Zadek and the prince and Farrar are having doubts about early on about whether they can trust the doctor. And I have nice to have doubts about the doctor's trustworthiness that aren't shouted. Because normally we have lots of shouting about how untrustworthy the doctor is, but not here. They're rationally discussing it. I like having the Archmandrite here. So an Archmandrite, the term can mean a few different things, but in this context, it means basically like the head of a monastery. Mm-hmm. And so they, at one point, and he's involved in the coronation of the king. He's the one who does the crowning, which is like, you know, in Europe, they'll frequently have an archbishop, you know, crown a monarch. And so the Archmandrite does it here. And then later, Count Grendel summons the Archmandrite to his castle to marry the real prince and Romana. And he pretending to be Princess Stella and the king. Before he knows that, the Archmandrite, when he shows up, says, "Why did you want me?" And Grendel says, "Oh, to perform a wedding." And he says, "Your own chaplain could have done that." I said, "Not this wedding. I want you to marry the king and the princess." So it's like, yeah, okay, the ordinary parish priest doesn't get to marry the king and the queen. Right. And that makes sense. One of the things that they do in this that I think would have been more impressive in 1979 is they have a bunch of on-screen shots of the android and the human that they're playing. Or in the case of Romana and Princess Strella, they'll get Romana and Princess Strella on screen together. Mm-hmm. And this would have, for modern people, we just accept this.
Right.
But back then it was like, oh, wow, we're seeing the same actor twice on the screen because they didn't have CGI back then. They couldn't just edit an image in like that. They had to do it with overlays and forced perspective. And you're always looking back then, you're always looking for a seam down the middle of the screen where, you know, to figure out how they did it. And it really wasn't until the 80s and the release of the Thomas Riker episode of Next Generation, where they have, you know, they have Will Riker standing in the middle of the shot, and Thomas Riker walks around him.
Right.
And at the time, that was mind-blowing. Audiences had never seen that before. And this is a few years earlier than that. So they do a pretty good job with getting the actor on the screen twice, but that would have been much more impressive back then than it is now.
Yeah. Now someone with Final Cut Pro can do it easily.
Yeah. But yeah, I remember the two Riker episode and how you could see, like, you look back now, you go, you could see where it's kind of fuzzy and what, but it was a big accomplishment. Yeah, I can't imagine the BBC had a budget for that sort of thing.
They always made sure that they were on split sides of the opposite sides of the screen.
Yeah,
you know, so that you never had to worry about that.
Jimmy, you mentioned the Archimandrite. played by Cyril Shapps, who, according to the TARDIS Wiki, says this was the only time he's been in four parts in Doctor Who, and this is the only one where he didn't die. So
yes,
and it was his last.
It was his last. So it's like, okay, finally, it's like Groundhog Day. Finally, you survived, and so therefore you get set free.
So I did like that. All right. So that's the androids of Tara. We do have some feedback, and let's get to that. Our first bit of feedback on Robots of Death came from MS, who wrote on YouTube, irrespective of the Agatha Christie plot, the flat characters with contrived motivations and some sloppy acting, I have a fondness for this story. Robots of Death is nostalgic since it's one of the earliest Doctor Who stories I can recall watching. To an imaginative and impressionable 9-year-old in the late 70s, it filled me with wonder and helped form my inner nerd. The Doctor's lesson on transdimensional engineering was an absolute joy. It represents the sort of witty and alien dialogue that was absent from most television at the time. How could you not smile when the lovely Louise Jameson bursts the Doctor's bubble with a response of, "That's silly." Yes, it's silly, but classic Who's whimsy is part of what drew me to it from shows like Trek at the time. A welcome relief from comical clarinets and burlesque musical cues. Father Corey mentioned the robots being creepy, especially their gentle, mellifluous voices when murdering the crew. What a stroke of genius that was. The actors added
kill gravitas. Kill all humans. Kill all humans.
Yeah.
Yes. The actors added gravitas, menace, and in the case of D-84, humor and pathos to otherwise lifeless but brilliant robot designs. I think I detected bits of Herbert's Dune with the setting, and although they didn't pull off a successful locked room mystery, the Sandminer was wonderfully claustrophobic and eerie. The stylized robot design, costumes, and makeup really helped establish the wealth, excesses, and affectations of the society's human story. Robots of Death is atmospheric, and I think an example of creativity emerging in part from the constraints placed on it. In the case of Doctor Who, a busy schedule and spare change budget. Gifted artisans can sometimes produce beautiful work under these conditions. Examples in this period that come to mind are the Ark in Space set, the jungle in Planet of Evil, and the Zygon costumes in organic tech. Great stuff. Finally, as a busy dad with a large family, I'm sure I speak for others when I say I've always hoped for access to a like-minded group to discuss these and other interests with. It's amazing for me to hear the common frames of reference and the different perspectives. Listening to the three of you opine respectfully and with good humor on Doctor Who and Star Trek has supplied me with many hours of joy and allowed me the occasional comment, especially when nights get long or times tough. Thanks. Thank you, MS.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Our next comment comes from Mark, who wrote on Facebook, regarding the human-robot buddy cop movie that we mentioned, look up the 1976-77 series Holmes and Yo-Yo, and he provides a Wikipedia link. This was a show starring John Shuck as Yo-Yo the Android. This is about a cop who got a new partner, and it turns out that the partner is a brand-new police department technology robot. Or Android.
Well, that's a deep cut.
I had forgotten about this for 40 years until he mentioned this.
I don't think I ever saw, I maybe saw this, but I don't have any clear memories of it at all. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't last. I think it didn't even last the whole season. So,
yeah.
But I remember as a kid seeing an episode of this at least. Yeah. And like, I remember vividly Yo-Yo, the android, opening up like his belly and seeing electronics inside, which we see Data do later on Next Gen.
What I remember in that regard is Jaime from Get Smart, who was the android on Get Smart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. That too. Finally, The Cloister Bell of A Journey Through Time and Space on YouTube writes, great video, guys. A few things that always stood out in this story were the robots with the 17th century French-styled features and the outlandish costumes and makeup of the crew. Good to see Brian Croucher from Blake 7, too. Oh, and Jimmy, that is a beautiful pup. Cheers.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was, when we filmed that episode, I was minding my sister's dog while she was out of town. And so her miniature Australian Shepherd was here in the studio with me.
Now, was Brian Croucher Uvanov in that one? Which one was Brian Croucher from Blake 7? I'm not a Blake 7 aficionado.
I'd have to look it up.
Yeah. I was just going to quickly see if I could find it in the TARDIS Wiki, and TARDIS Wiki doesn't organize things well. So
Neither does Memory Alpha.
Yeah, they need to do a better job of that. Let's see. No, that's not. Anyway, it's one of the. It must have been one of the other guest characters. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Cloister Bell, for your feedback and for everyone for your feedback. We do appreciate it. Now we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Doctor Who, including Jeff H., Chris N., Joseph B., Brian W., and Dustin B. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Doctor Who and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And we'd also like to thank Simon Yannick, who edited this episode. So that's it from us. We'd love to know what you thought of The Androids of Tara, this fourth Doctor story. Let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com, the Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page, send an email to doctorwho@sqpn.com, or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. You can watch The Secrets of Doctor Who on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/starquestmedia and leave a comment there. And we'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the fifth Doctor story, Warriors of the Deep.
Until then.
I always wait to... I've never seen any of these, so when I mention this at the end, I always wait to see your reactions to it, so I can anticipate what it's going to be like. So I'm sure this is going to be great. Until then, Father Corey Stika, thank you for joining me and sharing the Secrets of Doctor Who.
Thank you, Don.
Jimmy Akin, thank you as well.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who on StarQuest. And remember, fishing is an art worthy of the knowledge and practice of a wise man.